This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
I did not see where this guy had been reported missing. It's a December case and a December case, if that makes sense. The resolution happened in December as far as the announcement goes. But this is it's a nameless. He was known as Barn John Doe from 2004. On December 23rd, 2004, juveniles found a decomposed human skeleton in a barn in a wooded area near the intersection of Highway 69 South and FM 2813 in South Tyler in Smith County, Texas. He was wearing a blue jacket, blue jeans, a black baseball cap, and Rockport shoes. The medical examiner put into Namus as UP3216 that he was a Caucasian male thought to be between 27 and 42 years old. He was approximately 5'8" to 6'2" in height, with a medium to a large frame, average muscle development, and that he had likely died months earlier in 2004. So they've identified him. DNA Doe Project was on this one with the assistance of Major Crimes out of Tyler Police Department. On December 14th, they released on the DNA Doe Project page, which is a fantastic page. People want to check that out. It's got a lot of mysteries that are sort of in process. And they said, using investigative genetic genealogy, DNA Doe Project was able to solve the 17-year-old cold case of the man known only as Barn John Doe, 2004, since his discovery. His name is Kim Ryan Casey. He was born in 1952. He was last known to be living in Coppell, Texas, and they didn't give a specific timeline, but what they did say about the case was that it had some interesting challenges, including a DNA sample that was very small in quantity and heavily contaminated with bacteria. He doesn't look anything like the sketch, was one of the reasons I sent it to you. They show like this sort of Neanderthal surfer in the sketch. And
that's Kim a Case, good way to describe him.
Yeah, that's what the sketch looks like, right?
Yeah.
But the actual photo that they released of Kim Casey, he looks like a very, he kind of reminds me of a couple of actors who, you know, like Paul Giamatti and David Cross, like they play kind of these character roles. He looks very unassuming and sort of positive.
Yeah. So they said, so this may make a little bit more sense. Something has said that he was last seen 2003 or 2004, so it's not entirely, they're not entirely sure when, and he was homeless at the time.
Yeah, he was homeless. They think this seems like it's more natural death, like somebody seeking shelter and just not making it around Christmas. I think that makes it, I mean, they found him around Christmas, but I guess he had been there maybe the summer months he was trying to.
Well, but I, as far as the photos go, is what I'm saying. I imagine like the photos probably from several years earlier, because typically when you get to the point that you die in a barn, it's been a while since anybody's taken your picture.
Yeah, I would suppose that.
And makes so, sense. Based on sort of the picture we have, I mean, it is possible that his hair actually did look like that. But as far as the rest of him goes, I mean, he probably had lost a lot of weight. So I mean,
he was a little older than the range on it.
Yeah, no, I see that, but I can imagine. I'm just saying, given the picture, was he sitting in a chair? And he has a haircut, so he's not homeless, right? At that point, I'm just saying, I could see his appearance changing towards the Neanderthal surfer as that situation takes over.
Yeah, this Kevin Lord is the lab liaison for DNA Project, and he said that he was glad that despite the hurdles, they were able to identify Kim and bring some answers to his family. And then a volunteer genealogist named Missy Koski said that the research tree sent them as far away as Scotland to find common ancestors between DNA matches. They were challenged by matches that were more distantly related than expected, which was due to endogamy and the Kentucky and Missouri regions of the family tree. I thought that was interesting because I've never heard it phrased that way before. That's the short endogamy or endogamy, ever how you want to say it. The short version of that is people who marry within a specific type of person. It's not, how would I explain that? Okay, say you know a Romani person and they live in a family that is only marrying other Romani people, or a Jewish person who's only marrying other Jewish people, or an Amish person only marrying other Amish people. That's what endogamy is.
Well, I actually, I don't know much about that, but I would say on a DNA level, which is what we're talking about here, it is going to be some sort of something close to inbreeding.
I understand what you're saying as far as having possible common ancestors, but...
Well, like I said, it's going to be something. I mean, because we're basically talking the biology of it, right?
Yeah, we're talking the genetics of it.
Right. And so it's, let's see, endogamy.
I call it endogamy, and the opposite would be exogamy.
So endogamy. And
social science perspective.
Is the custom of marrying only within the limits of a local community, clan, or tribe compared with
exogamy.
And then the biological definition is the fusion of reproductive cells from related individuals, inbreeding, and self-pollination.
Right. But that's, so it's not close enough to be considered what I guess people would call incest.
Well, I didn't say that. I said inbreeding. He's got several trees that are meeting.
Right.
Like, I mean, limbs. Several limbs of the tree meet in various places.
Correct. And what happens invariably in groups like that is that there are common ancestors that they aren't necessarily even within two generations. But if you go back further, and like where you can really find this is like in the caste systems of, say, India.
Or like any royal family.
Any royal family. Yeah, you get to a point where the obligations of the rule of endogamy, like if that was a custom, you end up with people who have similar DNA ancestors down the line. That's 100% correct, biologically, yes. That was interesting that they closed that. They actually identified him in August, but they're just releasing it all now. I think it took them a little time to get everything together related to that, based on what I read. But it is considered a natural death. So that mystery is solved. And
it's really sad that it took that long.
It kind of is, yeah. I mean, it doesn't seem like it actually took that long as much as it took a while to get.
Well, if he is last seen in 03 or 04, like he was found pretty fast, just depending on when that was. I'm imagining it was sort of, I assume because he was homeless, you know, he had probably gone through something that made him end up that way. And then somebody probably remembered seeing him sometime and it was vague. Right.
Yeah.
And then if he kept to himself, you know, I imagine he was seeking shelter and he just didn't wake up one day.
Yeah. This actually, somebody started a thread on Web Sleuth about this. And I actually remember when the thread started. They started it the day that the body was discovered, which was the day after Christmas. And 2004 was a weird year for me. I had a lot of time where I was sitting in front of a computer because I had a very small child. And I actually remember reading this thread. I had it bookmarked, but somebody had posted the original article saying, you know, I hope this person can be found and located. And it's so interesting because the whole thread only has three pages.
Wait a second. You said you hope this person can be found and located, like the identity of the person?
A a person on Web Sleuth opened a thread the day after Christmas in 2004 with the article saying the body had been found in a barn.
Okay.
And they put at the top of the thread, hopefully this person can be identified and the family can be located.
I see. Okay.
I may have said it wrong, but that's
I just wasn't sure if you meant it, because I was looking for a missing persons report, and the way I heard it, which I could have heard anything, but I thought you had said, I hope this person is found and located, and I was like, wait, is that about a missing person, or is it about the found body? But it was about the found body.
Yeah, it was about the found body. So,
and he, more than likely, he was missing, but like he didn't have the interactions to be reported missing is what I'm guessing.
Yeah, he's 120 miles from where he was last seen. My guess, and I skimmed over that this morning because I was kind of interested in to see like what people had said back then. And like a lot of people thought it was going to be a woman.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a long time before they said it was a man. And that was based on the clothing. And somebody brought it up like 6 or 7 months later. It was an interesting thread. It only had, like I said, it only had 20 entries or so. And
I always wonder, like in situations, which I don't know what kind of area the body was found in.
What was it, a barn?
Well, I was going to say it was barn John Doe, but I always feel like bodies that died of natural causes, like seeking shelter, it's almost always going to be a homeless person, probably almost always not going to be reported missing.
Yeah, this was a little circle of trees behind a church. They had a barn in there, and church members had gone into the barn, and they found the body. But it was like kids at Christmas who were bored while the family, it was a Baptist church having like a, you know, a Christmas meal.
Surprise. Merry Christmas.
Yeah. So the kids had gone outside, and it's Texas, you know, and it wasn't snowing or bad weather. The kids were just messing around and went into this abandoned building and they found the body there. So we're continuing our episodes of Christmas here. This one is... there were a lot of elements to it that I was sort of like, what is going on? This is the father charged with murdering his family. Had you ever heard of this guy before?
No, I have not.
Something about the court documents here, because I pulled up a bunch of the court documents. Elements of this case go all the way to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, I think. And they had issued an opinion about some stuff. When I was looking at it, something about it felt familiar. And then there's this whole thing where his brother, his younger brother, gets dragged into it. And it was really, that was really disappointing. What was interesting about this case to me is it has somehow escaped like the Wikipedia realm. Like there's been podcasts who've covered it. It's not that we're being totally unique here, but it hasn't been one of those cases where there were really clear documentaries about it or like good news articles. There was just some mentions here and there of what's happened. So it was a little difficult to piece together. And when I read it, I was actually really shocked because it almost seems like some of these other sort of Christmas slayings, I guess, that we've read about where, you know, for some reason there's a kid involved. And I think a couple of the cases, that one case with, the Zero to the Bone case, that case had some elements of this. The Lawson Family Massacre, we didn't cover that, but that had some elements of this. This guy is off the chain. He really is. So this is Ernest Huhlaber Jr. And I'm saying it Huhlaber. If somebody wants to call it Huhlaber or something like that, I'm maybe mispronouncing this guy's name because my experience with this one has been in writing. But
well, you're covering all the letters, so I don't...
This is one of those cases that you can't unhear, so I guess I should preface it that and say this is a 2002 case, so there's no spoilers to what I'm about to say, but there maybe should be some trigger warnings going on here, because this has definitely got a lot of family murder, incest, other things going on, sexual assault of children. Oh, wow. It's a mouthful on this one. So from the Chicago Tribune on January 14, 2003, they covered it and they just said father and husband now charged in murdering family. And this is out of Dauphin County, Pennsylvania. A father charged with sexually molesting his two daughters has now also been charged with the Christmas Eve murders of the two young women and their mother. 42-year-old Ernest Hulliver Jr. was charged Tuesday with killing his estranged wife, 43-year-old Jean, and their daughters, 20-year-old Victoria and 15-year-old Elizabeth, after breaking into their Middleton home as his brother Scott waited in a car. The victims were found on Christmas morning. Each had suffered a single gunshot wound to the head from a .22 caliber weapon. Dauphin County District Attorney Edward Marsico Jr. said Tuesday morning that he will not decide whether or not to pursue the death penalty until arraignment. However, he said that various circumstances exist under which he could pursue the death penalty, including the killing of a witness in a court case. Marsico said, killing three people in an attempt to subvert the criminal justice system is a horrendous act and one that calls for severe punishment. Hulliver had been free on $100,000 bail pending trial on charges that he sexually molested his daughters. His bail was revoked and he was arrested on January the 2nd because authorities were concerned that he would attempt to flee before the upcoming sexual assault trial. His 28-year-old brother, Scott, was charged January the 3rd with three counts of homicide as an accomplice. He remains in the Dauphin County Jail being held without bail. Authorities have charged Ernest with three counts of murder, which means prosecutors must prove he acted with malice and forethought rather than a blanket charge of criminal homicide, which includes several degrees of murder, voluntary and involuntary manslaughter. He's also charged with burglary, reckless endangerment, and related counts. The endangerment charge is related to Victoria's, that's the 20-year-old, 9-month-old daughter Madison, who police found unharmed near her mother's body. The charges against Ernest were filed upon a recommendation by the investigating grand jury, which heard testimony last week. Up until now, the investigation of this case has taken place in secret with sealed warrants, secret testimony, and behind closed doors, said Ernest's attorney, Spiro T. Lapas. The filing of these charges entitles Mr. Hulliver to a speedy public trial, and we anxiously await the opportunity to defend this case in open court. According to the grand jury documents, which is called a presentment, Scott Hulliver first told police he and his brother were looking for deer in Cambria County at the time the homicides occurred, but later told police that he drove his brother halfway across the state to the Middleton home of his wife and daughters. According to the presentment, Scott said that they were drinking early on December 24th at a Cambria County bar when his brother said he wanted to go to his former home to get his dog. Under the conditions of his bail release in the sexual assault case, Ernest had been barred since July from visiting the home or contacting his family. The presentment states that Scott said he parked a block away from the home around 4 a.m. on December 24th and watched his brother walk toward it, returning 10 minutes later in an agitated state, telling his brother to drive away. Scott also indicated that on a prior occasion, Ernest had indicated that he would kill Jean, Victoria, and Elizabeth, the grand jury presentment states. The presentment also states that an uncle of the brothers said they did not come home on the night of the killings and that a .22 caliber revolver was seized during a search of the home of Ernest Hulliver Sr. in Cambria County, where Ernest Jr. was living since the sexual assault charges were filed against them. Martico said that ballistic tests have not determined whether the .22 caliber revolver seized in the search was the murder weapon. And according to the presentment, police found a broken garage window at the Hulliver home, through which the garage door could be opened and an intruder could get inside. So that's the main part of the case. What do you think about that so far?
I can't really get inside of the head of a father who kills. I mean, I understand more so the wife. I understand more when husbands kill their wife, but I probably am never going to understand how fathers kill their children.
Yeah, that was a weird one for me. I
can't imagine. Clearly, he needed help. He needed psychological help. He was having I'm sure the drinking didn't help. So it seems like, unfortunately, and this is probably me stating the blatantly obvious, but it seems like people who have mental health problems, they get exacerbated when they decide to go drinking all night. I feel really sorry for the brother. Now, so according to what you said, he told his brother he wanted to go and get his dog.
Right.
And then it appears he initially lied to investigators and then he came clean about it. And he ended up getting charged with third degree murder. Honestly, if he legitimately drove his brother there to get his dog, I don't feel like he should have been charged with third degree murder, but...
Well, I mean, obviously they don't believe him.
Well, no, because like this is the kind of thing, especially under these particular circumstances where you've got the court case ongoing and the restraining order. I would say that it's a pretty safe bet that when three people are dead in a house where there is a restraining order in place, the person on the other side of the restraining order probably did it.
It would be a statistical anomaly for...
It's not impossible, but it's very improbable.
So this is one of those that like pops up in Snap or something later on. I haven't seen anything about this.
Don't you think just by knowing that, like, you know, what we just knowing that you're going to be the suspect, wouldn't that help you decide not to do it?
There is no way. I can't fathom how you get into the frame of mind that like the best way out of the situation you created is to kill someone.
Right. And then discussing the death penalty, they talk about how, you know, it was possibly witness tampering, right?
Yes.
Except that... I know that this is not the state of mind that somebody who participates in witness tampering comes from, but like if you're in trouble for one thing and you kill the witness against you, like you're going to be in more trouble than you were in to begin with.
I mean, obviously.
But, and so to me, like rational people go, wait, I'll just take my licks on the lesser thing, right?
I mean, that's what you would think, yeah.
But I know that this guy's clearly not a rational guy. But now, do you know, has he been put to death yet?
No. He's not been put to death.
Okay, go ahead.
The way that this breaks, this is sort of part two, I guess. So the way that this breaks out is, you know, we know what happens with this. But Scott ends up pleading guilty. He agrees to cooperate as a Commonwealth witness. He leads police out to Clearfield County, where they retrieve firearms and other evidence. And the prosecution decides that they're going to take those previous counts of sexual assault and rape, and they're going to roll them all together. And they're going to consolidate it into a trial. Hulaver, his lawyers argue that they need a change of venue. So a change of venue occurs for Ernest. At trial, the Commonwealth presents Scott as a central witness. He testified that following Gene's decision to seek a divorce, which is what sort of kicks that off, and we keep hearing that, these people are scared to death to be alone. Hulaver stated that he was going to shoot her. Ernest stated, I'm going to shoot Gene. So Scott, on the stand, describes the trip to the Middleton residence, indicating that Hulaver had claimed he only wanted to retrieve his dog. I'm going to just call him Ernest. So Scott describes the trip to the Middletown residence on Christmas Eve, indicating that Ernest has told him he only wants to get the dog. The trip involves further activities and was corroborated by surveillance video that was obtained by the police from a convenience store located halfway between Ernest Sr.'s house and Gene's house, which is Cambria County in Middleton. Scott then testified that upon arrival in Middleton, he was told to stop the vehicle to permit Ernest to get in the back seat. And then Ernest told him to drive to a location about a block from Gene's house. He parked the vehicle there and he waited as Ernest went towards the house. Ernest comes back out 5 or 10 minutes later and tells him to drive out to Clearfield County, where Ernest pulls out a shotgun that he has tucked back into the vehicle. So he got it out, you know, he had it at the house. He brings it back, he puts it in the car. Scott is the witness who watches Ernest go back and forth from their vehicle to the woods. And then Ernest tells him to repeat the false story if asked about his whereabouts during the time period. So they come up, essentially that's the alibi that Ernest creates, and he has Scott repeat it. There were several prisoner witnesses or jailhouse informants who are on the stand after Scott, and they describe various incriminating statements made by Ernest, as well as Ernest trying to, from jail, he's trying to hire a hitman to kill a guy named Francisco Ramos, who is the father of Victoria's child. Up until here, by the way, in the court record, they led me to believe that Ernest was the father of Victoria's child. They want this guy, the hitman is from West Virginia. They want him to kill baby daddy. And then they want him to fabricate evidence suggesting that Francisco was the one who had killed Jean, Victoria, and Elizabeth. So basically, he tries to, from jail, set up this elaborate plot to get off of... He's basically trying to have a potential witness killed, even though that guy's not really relevant, to frame him for these murders that he is about to go on trial for. So early in that process, the jailhouse informant, who they keep calling a prisoner witness, he gets the cops involved. He gets the corrections officers involved. And what they do is they start documenting through an undercover effort, which includes some recording. They start documenting Ernest's ongoing solicitation attempts. And it's, this shit reminds me of have you heard about the rentahitman.com thing?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's like that level of stupid. And that, for people who haven't seen, go look that up. That's a fun one. Don't look the website up. God, you'll get on a list. But look up the woman who literally goes to rentahitman.com most recently, and there's been several, and tries to rent a hitman. That's what this is like. The defense acknowledges that Ernest was talking to these undercover. One's an officer, the other one's a jailhouse informant, but the gist is they acknowledge his role in the conspiracy, but they suggest that the attempt reflected the efforts of a distraught husband and father who wanted to avenge the killing of his family against the man he believed was the perpetrator. And he just wanted to make sure he was truly good and caught. So the defense theory of the case ends up recognizing that Mr. Ramos is not the killer, but asserts that another man who had also been intimately associated through witnesses with Victoria was the perpetrator of the murder. Ballistics evidence presented, it connected the pistol found in the Clearfield County that Scott led the police to the killings. It was not a great match because both the firearm and the bullets were heavily degraded. The Commonwealth presented evidence that the pistol was registered to an uncle of Ernest's. During the preliminary hearing, the Commonwealth decided to introduce testimony of Elizabeth and Victoria from the sexual assault case under the forfeiture by wrongdoing exception to the hearsay rule on the theory they were killed to prevent their testimony. So there are exceptions to hearsay. Hearsay is when someone gets on the stand and they are telling you what someone else has said that they did not witness about someone saying or doing something. In this instance, this exception is if you kill the witness, then previous testimony they might have had or video or written statements or witnesses to their statements can come into play under the exception that because you killed them to prevent them from saying anything, their testimony is allowed to be presented. Ernest ends up convicted of first-degree murder for each killing and all of the separate crimes. And then they aggravate the conviction by saying that he was killing prosecution witnesses. That's worse than just killing a person. You're killing someone who already had taken action against you. They got him for conspiracy, for reckless endangerment of the 9-month-old that was left at the scene, for burglary, and for criminal solicitation related to all the stuff that he did surrounding having Mr. Ramos killed. However, he does get acquitted of the sexual offenses. In the penalty phase of the trial, the Commonwealth pursued the in perpetration of a felony, grave risk, multiple murders, and protection from abuse violation aggravated in the penalty phase of most court hearings, even the smallest ones that only take a few hours, you get to present two types of factors. The first type is a mitigating factor. A mitigating factor means it's a reason that the sentence maybe should not lean towards the maximum end or have an aggravating factor attached to it, meaning some type of abuse or some type of reason. I put that in big air quotes for everybody. But a mitigating factor is essentially a softener to the sentence. An aggravating factor is a hardener to the sentence, meaning it leans it more to the maximum end. So they end up incorporating the evidence that was brought up during the guilt phase. So the first part of the trial, all of that evidence comes back in, and they say this is all aggravating factors. Ernest lawyers basically presented the catch-all mitigator of he has no significant history of prior criminal convictions, which, whatever, at that point, he's already going to be on trial no matter what he does here for the sexual assault of his daughters. Whether he did that or not, that's between him and some other maker. But the behavior is definitely premeditated if they're accepting that he did this. So the jury found that all the aggravators, at least some of the proffered mitigating factors, were probably true. But they decided that based on the balance between the two of them, that they recommended three death sentences as a consequence of their determinations, like what they were doing there and how they were seeking that out. And I think that is accurate. What do you think of the death penalty in this case?
I think that first of all, I was confused because it seems like they should have, instead of presenting an alternate suspect in, like, first the baby daddy and then somebody else, right? Some unnamed person. It seems like that they would have needed to present Scott as a possible perpetrator because of his link to the evidence. And so to me, that makes the defense fail. Because so without, like, if you don't say, well, Scott did it, then how are you justifying him coming forth with the knowledge of the, it can't completely be matched, but it's most likely the same gun and that shot these bullets, right?
Right.
To me, that's not even a defense. Because I don't know if they closed that link in the course of testimony or not. To me, that was a terrible defense because you've got pretty much direct evidence leading to it. I imagine this could be another one of our public service announcements that when your drunk brother who's in trouble with his family wants to go pick up his dog, you can drive him over and tell him to wait in the car while you go get it.
Or you can take him to the nearest rescue
and let him rescue three new dogs.
Then you can get new dogs.
Because I have a feeling, I really don't. So how old is he? How old's Ernest?
He would have been 42 and Scott would have been 28. Okay, 14 and years between them.
I heard the 28. And so I have a feeling Scott was mortified that he was involved in any way, shape, or form in this situation. I don't feel like there was any sort of ill will from him. And I imagine the only thing that was tying him to his brother, like even to be in his presence, was the fact that he was his brother,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he was the only one.
It just seems to me like, I don't know, when you get to a point in life where, you know, both of your daughters have accused you of bad things, your wife is divorcing you, you're living with your father, perhaps you shouldn't get your younger brother that's hanging out with you in trouble for murder.
Yeah.
But that didn't cross this guy's mind. I do feel like the death penalty was absolutely appropriate here. I was curious if he had been put to death yet.
No, he's still alive. I was going to say this for the end of the episode, but I'll just go ahead and say it now. I did go looking them up, like their current records. So Scott appears to have been released. It looks like he's still on. I think there was some kind of deal where he got out for good behavior. And I don't have an official record of this. I'm just going by what I can find. It looks like he had no infractions. He got out for basically good behavior some time ago and was put on sort of a modified probation.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a parole probation period that he's still under, but it looks like it's expiring soon. And the reason I kept Fist till the very end is, have you ever seen pictures of Ernest? Were they in the articles I sent you?
I've seen pictures of him. Yeah, I don't know if they were in the articles you sent me, but yeah, I've seen him.
So when he was on trial and stuff, he had like dark hair and sort of a, I don't know, he sort of looked like a slightly shabby businessman, if that makes sense. Like he had a suit and blah, blah, blah. So I pulled up his, did you find it?
No, I didn't.
So not his mugshot, his mugshots and his court stuff and all the news articles. He totally looks normal. But I pulled up this, which is from May of this year. He had to be transported, so they took a new picture of him. I thought you would enjoy it.
Well, I would say he's gotten just about what he deserves in prison.
I mean, does that remind you of anybody there?
Santa Claus?
He looks just like Santa Claus. Yeah, he even had a red jumpsuit on.
So I would like to know, I would like to hear what this guy has to say about what he did.
Do you really want to know that?
Well, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be him. It just, the reason I had asked way earlier was like, is he alive, right? Because most of the time, by the time I get to these types of cases, the person has been put to death already, right? And so I've always been looking for a person who has done a heinous crime that didn't, hasn't been put to death and that didn't kill themselves in the process of committing the crime, which is the other thing that tends to happen.
Okay.
And that's why I ask. Now, do I really want to know? Well, I don't know. I actually have no idea what he would say, but it's so out of my realm of being able to grasp, like, where he was headed with all this, except nowhere, right? I would just love to hear the explanation. Because, you know, in court, I assume he didn't testify on his own behalf.
But he's not in the record, so no.
In court, you know, it's one road, right? And it's a, and then what really happened is that parallel road, right?
Right.
But in, so in court, it goes one way, and they explain it, you know, to the best of that they can under the circumstances. And, but I would really, without judgment, okay, so I'm not judging him. What's done is done. He's paying for his crimes. I would genuinely like to know, like, how he got to that point.
So I can't tell you, there's a number of things going on with this guy. So this all happened pretty quickly. I don't know if you caught the sort of time frame, but July 2002 is when he is charged with multiple sexual offenses involving conduct with his two daughters. And then December 24, 2002, so, you know, within a half a year, is when the crime occurs. He then ends up on trial pretty quickly. And everything is, for all intents and purposes, entered into court in August of 2004. So it's sort of wrapped up and has a bow on it. And like the death penalty is delivered in, as a judgment of sentence on August 31st, 2004. And then, so over the course from August 2004 through May 9th, 2006 is the appellate process for this.
Right.
They go through, and so the record on this is pretty lengthy, but it's pretty boring, to be honest with you. It's almost like a one-day trial. And it's not, it's multiple days and it's lots of witnesses. But what I'm saying is, like, you know, in a day, like, you could, like, from what they present the first day, you just know he did it. Not only did he do it, like, there's no one else who could have done all of the things. So, and here's what I mean by that. It's his brother. It's his uncle's gun. It's their car. His brother's admitted that he drove him there. It's his fingerprints on the back of the house, cutting the telephone and other wires before he then breaks a window and leaves fingerprints and blood. There's not anyone else.
He should have just pled guilty. Yeah.
He should have pled it out. They probably would have made some. So they argue all his lawyers, he must have paid like everything he had left to these lawyers. They did an amazing job. I do not think he was indigent. But the gist of what was going on with these lawyers and the appellate process is, first of all, during the trial on the record, they preserved every possible notion for appeal and basically ruled out the possibility of him suffering from any deprivation from ineffective assistance of counsel. So that doesn't really come into play because they it is literally preserved almost line by line, starting with the arrest warrants and then going all the way through every document they have. They object, argue, and have motions ready for search warrants related to when they go and, you know, take Scott out and get weapons, and when they search the homes and all of those things. They're saying they're overly broad, and the court keeps ruling on everything along the way.
And I just want to point out, because it seems like this has come up several times. So basically, when a jury trial occurs, and I'm sure people watch them, and, you know, you'll have, if it's a TV show, it's very dramatic. If it's an actual trial, it's less dramatic. But, you know, whoever's talking, the other party will object. And then the judge either sustains the objection or he overrules the objection. So if it's sustained, it means he agrees with the objection and whatever they're objecting to has to stop. If he overrules it, then that means that the person who is speaking can continue whatever it is they're doing.
And that was objected to.
That the other side has objected to. However, on appeal, all those objections become relevant. Because if you did not mention something during a trial, and if you did not raise an objection at the time it's occurring in real time, you haven't preserved the issue for appeal. And so the way our justice system works is, like, you can't argue one case in front of the jury during your jury trial and then go back and find all the stuff you missed the first time around and take it to the appeals court. So each and every time there's an objection made, it's more for the record than anything else. It really doesn't, I mean, it does matter what the trial court says, but if the trial court were to sustain something that should have been
overruled.
I'm sorry, if they overruled something that should have been sustained, the appeals court can say, well, that should not have been allowed, or it should have been allowed, and they go from there. But you can't bring up any new issues on appeal. The only thing the appeals courts will do is review anything that went wrong at trial.
Yeah, this applies to the direct and immediate appeal. So when you hear about things like new evidence being tested and things like that, typically that comes from people filing for, like, after appeals have been exhausted. When you hear about it in the news, they're filing for motions of appropriate relief, or they're filing for different habeas motions. But that's not appellate processes. That's different.
Right. And now you can bring stuff like that up, but typically, from an evidentiary point of view, like, you would have needed to have attempted to present it, or provide reasonings like, you know, the prosecution didn't say they had it, that kind of thing. And so that kind of comes into play. But yeah, so for new territory, it's a completely different thing. But, you know, we're all entitled to one jury trial.
Right.
And that's why you want to have an attorney that's on it.
Yeah.
Because when you're, now it doesn't really seem fair because you don't really realize all this stuff, right?
Right.
And if you've got not so great attorneys, like, and they don't do their job, well, from what I have researched, you're going to have to find a really good attorney that's going to be able to explain that, like, you had ineffective assistance of counsel. And, you know, some of the things that ineffective assistance of counsel would represent is not properly preserving issues for an appeal.
Right. So this guy, when he gets to the appellate courts, he brings up every single issue that was objected to along the way. It's a fun document. It's available on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's website. Ultimately, Pennsylvania decides that the convictions will stand and the sentences will stand. Although I will say that he is alive. To what degree that matters, I don't even know.
I don't have a lot of experience with Pennsylvania, and it's
I don't either. And when I go through it, the judgments, the convictions and the judgments of sentences were affirmed from the last document I find related to this. That doesn't mean there's some I haven't found yet. That doesn't mean that, like, there wasn't some kind of finagling that changed something here. But I wanted to point out this in a wrap up. You asked, I wonder what that guy was thinking. That appellate document that I read, the appellate documents that I read, they sort of drop off. But in 2012, on December 24th, 2012, nonetheless, Ernest shows back up in the news. It's for the weirdest reason. So in 2012, he was serving his three death sentences in Waynesburg State Prison, which is in Greene County, Pennsylvania. He had been acquitted of charges that he raped his daughter. So for some reason, he decides that he wants to apply for an expungement of the charges of rape because he was acquitted of them during the 2004 trial. And my jaw dropped.
Charges expunged?
Expungement usually results from an acquittal, but this is not that kind of situation. So in a response filed December 14th, 2012, to what's going on here, Dauphin County First Assistant District Attorney at that time, Fran Chardo, asked the court to keep the charges on Hooliver's record. The charges were vital to the prosecution's theory of Hooliver's motive for the slayings. Authorities say that Hooliver killed them because he wanted to prevent his daughters from testifying that he had repeatedly raped them. If those charges remain, they would probably be admissible to show his motive to commit these murders. An expungement usually results from an acquittal, Chardo said, but there are special circumstances here. Chardo said in the petition that Hooliver's attempt to expunge the rape count should be rejected because he achieved the acquittals through the murder of three principal witnesses against them. The killings took place less than a month before the girls planned to testify that he had sexually molested them for years. During the 2004 trial, the prosecutors were hamstrung on the sexual assault charges because they had to rely on the transcript of a hearing that took place before the women died. Anyways, I just thought it was interesting. That probably should tell you what kind of person this is.
Well, and I will say, while this is another good example of the parallel roads, while it does appear he might have killed them to silence them, that's not what he did. He killed them because he was mad. He was mad that his life blew up. He was mad that his daughters told on him and that his wife was divorcing him, because killing them didn't solve his problem. I mean, he ends up in jail. I don't feel like he was trying to avoid going to jail for what he did. I think he was mad that his life had ended.
Yeah, so I would agree with you that his...
But that's kind of why I would like to know. Like, I would, because in the parallel roads here, I imagine he's got an attorney that thinks that this is the way to go. Now, I just want to point out, when you sit and listen to defense attorneys come up with defenses for their defendant clients, okay, they're doing their job. right?
Yes.
And some of the things that defense attorneys are like sort of cornered into having to do, just from, because if he, like with this guy, I mean, he won't take a plea deal. He's determined to go to trial. You know, they have to come up with a defense. And in when I say that, like, yeah, it's great to think that we're all innocent until proven guilty. But if you're sitting there and the state proves its case, which I feel like it did in this case, and I haven't even reviewed the trial, just on the outset, the fact that his brother was testifying against him and the what has been sort of summarized as his testimony, I feel like they proved their case, right?
Yeah.
And so he's got to put on a defense. And so I know it's a lot of times I hear or I read or people just make comments, and I feel like defense attorneys sometimes get, you know, kind of kicked because they do things that, you know, you're kind of like, what were they thinking? Well, they're just doing their job. There's only so much that you can do. And usually in criminal law, a defense attorney is going to, like, the first thing they do is they try to pretend like, you know, a crime didn't happen at all. Right.
Yeah.
And then it's like the next thing will be, well, the crime happened, but my client wasn't involved. And then they present alternative options. Right.
Right.
And it is ludicrous. Like, it really, and especially in this situation, I'm surprised that they didn't try to somehow implicate the brother, because that seems like it would have made more sense as a defense strategy. But they didn't.
He eventually gets there. So the way that this goes down in terms of just like Ernest Hulover's lawyers, so they try this expungement thing in 2012. It's denied on January 9th, 2013. The petition doesn't get through. He appeals it in 2014. And it looks like it's part of a bigger scheme to continue to appeal things at the federal system. There are, so all of the documents in here are sort of hard to read, and here's why. The attorneys are pretty much out of it by 2016. And what ends up happening is he starts filing documents for himself pro se. So that's why I say, like, as far as the court documents go, like, I haven't seen anything where they've ruled other than to just affirm things. Does that make sense?
Is he asking for his sentence to be commuted or for a new trial or what?
He's raised issues such as wanting post-conviction relief. He's claimed that his lawyers were ineffective. He's had over 20 different arguments that he's raised pro se. But those don't get very far in cases like this. Because so a pro se argument that would work would be there's new evidence and somebody gets wind of it and they decide to help. But
still like a really long road, though.
It's a long road. And all it really does typically is get the attention of lawyers who can assist you. But the main thing that happens in a case like his is he's a death penalty case. So some people will take up a death penalty cause without real reason to take up a death penalty cause, like right, what happened with Ted Bundy.
You just want to make sure that, well, I feel like any defense attorney, at some point in their career would work on a death penalty case, even not being paid, because it is sort of it's the biggest bend in our legal system, in that, like, you know, you can't take it back. Now, I would argue that people are sentenced to sit on death row. They aren't, I mean, they're sentenced to death, but like, how many people really get put to death, right?
Yeah.
I was going to say, one of the things about being on death row is that I don't think the court will ever order him to stop his nonsense.
No, they probably won't. It looks like all the way through 2020, there was another podcast that covered this a couple of years back, and essentially they referenced the ongoing appeals, which is how I found out there was still stuff sort of pending. But the gist of this is, he will probably not stop, and he will eventually get some help from people who just, and I understand what you're saying about defense attorneys, but there are people out there who just cannot stand the death penalty, and they will rail against it with whatever case they can, by whatever means they can.
I feel like they're going to have a really hard time getting this overturned.
This will never get overturned. I don't even think.
I mean, even commuted.
I don't
to
even
life.
Think it'll be commuted to life in prison. Yeah. I do think they might succeed in him writing out the moratoriums, if that makes sense.
Like until he dies.
Yeah, like he's old enough. So if you think about it.
They died in 2004. It was Christmas Eve 2004.
Okay, so 17 years have gone by here.
He's, what, 59?
And since, yeah, he would be.
Gosh, he looks so much older than that.
He really does. the years, like, he's definitely paying for what he did there to those poor people. But there is a moratorium on the death penalty that was announced in 2000. I think it was in 2015. I don't think that it's. I don't think that it has continued. They can still sentence someone, but they're not going to execute someone.
Is that specifically in Pennsylvania, or just?
It's just Pennsylvania. It's the governor's job to do that. I think it was Governor Wolf that did it, and I want to say they haven't actually executed anyone since the 90s.
I know that you've got multiple layers of things that come into play with the death penalty. I imagine the only thing they were offering him was life in prison if they were even inclined to make a plea. I'm not certain they can give a plea deal for the death sentence. I don't really see how that would be a plea deal, but
it would be rare. I mean, we've kind of gone over that a little bit in the past, but like the death sentence itself is not usually on the table for plea bargains.
It's literally they offer life to avoid a trial. That in a capital case that could warrant the death penalty. And I do think that I don't think that there is any hope for this case. I feel like it's actually
for
one
the defendant,
of
you mean.
For the defendant, as far as getting it overturned, or I don't know that he'll be put to death. There's several layers of protection between even once you're on death row, because, you know, you're looking at a situation where a governor has to sign a death warrant. And just like they have to sign a death warrant, they also don't have to sign a death warrant. And that's actually where the moratoriums come into play, because some governors just, sure, death penalties are great, but I'm not going to be the one responsible for it.
Yeah. Anything else that you saw out of this case would actually, I think at this point, and I could go back and look more specifically at the record and then all the appellate matters that I was able to see, I think it would actually have to go federal at this point. And it doesn't seem like that effort has been taken up yet, but I didn't think prior to us recording, I didn't think to go into Pacer and look around. It could be that there's something in there where like a new effort is being made. So what's interesting about that is if he's going to be, you know, 50, whatever.
I believe 59, I believe.
People don't live as long in prison. So I don't even know.
He looks like he's about 89.
He looks very old. If you go looking for a picture of him, the picture that you'll find in the public, he has short, dark hair. His face is pretty nondescript. He's wearing a tie in most of them. And it kind of just looks like, you know, a typical American dad kind of, or a character from a cartoon almost. It reminds me of Principal Skinner from The Simpsons with the hair.
Yeah,
and stuff.
A little bit.
But if you were to dig in and look at the current mugshot they have on file with the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, he is much larger. His hair is long and wild, and he has a beard that comes like all the way down to where on a man's chest, where his almost where his nipples would be, or his xiphoid process would be. So it's like a big Santa Claus beard. It's very gray. His eyes are like sunken in. He does not look like time has been his friend at all.
Well, nor should he, honestly.
So that was one more of our episodes of Christmas. Thank you for joining us. We are sponsored by LabbrotiCreations.com. You can check them out at LabbrotiCreations.com, and you can still use the code CRIMEXS for a fun pop pet portrait of your own pet. You can also reach us on Twitter, Instagram, at TrueCrimeXS, or you can give us a call if you know anything about any of the cases that we're talking about at 252-365-3000.
5593. You can also reach us at Gmail at truecrimexs@gmail.com. And you can check out our website at www.truecrimexs.com. We'll see you next time.